Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello and welcome to Eureka, the show that gets under the skin of science in a good way, as we invite a new expert every week to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
And today is our Halloween special.
Woohoo! Or should I say, woo? I mean, if I was doing this episode, if I was leading it, you'd be like, it'd just be crammed with fantastic puns.
Yeah, I think I speak for everyone listening when I say, thank fuck it isn't you leading.
Rude.
But true.
Yeah, so I'm as someone who I know used to channel the devil to heat apples, you're perfect for this, aren't you, really? I mean, well, occultist Rick Edwards.
Yeah, I mean, that's a long time ago, and it does make me think maybe I need to stop oversharing on this podcast.
Are you going to talk listeners through that?
No, I mean, I think I have spoken about it before. I just tried to. It's simple. We've all done it. I tried to heat
up. No, we haven't.
I tried to heat up an apple.
Using the power of your mind.
Using the power of my Satan-infested mind. And, you know, I think we've, yeah, fine.
Yeah, it didn't work, by the way, if anyone's interested.
No, but I thought that it did, and it freaked me out. Anyway.
Which is actually my favourite detail of the whole thing.
I know. Pathetic. But we're going to talk about being scared, and I was trying to think of times when I've been genuinely scared, and I've got two that are quite different. Have you got any?
I've got one that I can think of.
Okay, you can. Right. We'll sandwich yours. All right. I'm going to do my one that is genuine terror. Was on a plane in my early 20s, I guess, and we just hit like the worst turbulence that I've ever experienced in a plane, and I've got no way really of measuring whether it was genuinely awful turbulence, but yeah, I think it was, because interestingly, the people weren't screaming. People just went really fucking quiet.
Yeah, that's not good,
because everyone was just like, oh my. And I was with a girl, and I was pretending, because I thought you've got, in this situation, you need to try and like, not like be the big man, but just be reassuring.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was saying to her, it's fine. Like, literally, they will have tested for this. Like, of course, planes know they're going to hit turbulence. Yeah. And it's gonna feel like this. And as I was saying that, we hit a bit where it honestly felt like we'd, like, smacked into a brick wall. And I was just like, and this is totally fine. And as I was saying, I was just thinking, I don't believe this for a second. I think we might die. That's the most sort of viscerally scared I think I've ever been.
So I can think of another plane incident, and weirdly, I was on a plane flying out of Seattle. One of the engines caught on fire.
Oh, fuck off.
No, seriously, it just like big boof. And he looked out the window. We were sat over the wing, and you could just see like one of the engines on fire. Mm. But I thought I would be scared. But actually, the bloke sat next to Philip on the other side said, "Oh, not again." And basically the cabin crew just sort of rolled their eyes and went to sit back down, like, oh God, we're gonna have to go back. And they just sort of, announcement came on, it's like, oh, we're gonna have to go back. So I wasn't scared at all, because nobody around me seemed bothered by this at all. I've had, you know, what I would call a kind of fear of dying while swimming in a triathlon, and I'm sure I've told you about this, but waves were really big. It was an ocean swim and waves were huge. And I just couldn't see anyone else, couldn't see lifeguards or anything. And I just, I had a panic attack basically, and just thought I was going to die and this is, I'm going to drown. And I didn't, but I also told myself, you don't have to go through this shit anymore. No. And I've never done another triathlon since.
No, no.
But the time when I was sort of spookily scared was, I'd been to see a play in Hastings, and I remember because it was one of Philippa's colleagues' husbands was in,
stop
in the play.
Stop making out like you're always going to plays, bro. You're not.
And we stayed in this B&B in Hastings, and this woman opened the door who was running the B&B, and I swear, in my memory, the door creaks as it opens. And I can't remember her name for the life of me. It was something weird. So it was sort of a weird Greek name. Like, I think it might have been Aphrodite or something.
What?
And she opened the door, and she said, in the name of Brooks. And we were like, shit, what have we got ourselves into? And I swear, it was like a gothic house, and she was the creepiest woman I'd ever come across. And I slept on
with
my back. That's quite a pivot. Just so that she wouldn't drain my blood. No, I literally slept.
If I was crude, I'd say, no, drain this. But luckily, I'm not.
Luckily, I'm not. Yeah. I slept on my back with my arms crossed across my chest because I got it into my head. This was going to keep her away. I was.
Yeah, perfect. Just sleep like you're in a coffin.
Yeah.
Make her life easier.
It just got into my head. It was horrible.
Yeah.
Worst breakfast I've ever had in a B&B, by the way.
Breakfast for Brooks.
So weird.
And then a little wink because of last night.
But I was genuine. I don't know why I got so scared, because it just seems ridiculous. But it's a bit like that thing about if you're in a haunted house, you are going to actually, despite everything you know about being rational and logical, you are going to be scared. And it was like being in a haunted house.
Okay, my second very scared memory, pretty sure I have told you this before, is when I was a kid and I would say to my parents, I don't like black and white films. And they were like, it's not a genre, you little idiot. And I'd be like, I don't like them, they're boring. And so they made me watch Psycho on my own. I mean, this is weird.
Oh, good parenting.
Yeah, really good parenting. So curtains pulled, definitely. I'm pretty sure on my own, but I need to check with them on that. But I think on my own, and like Psycho's terrifying anyway.
Yeah.
But at that age, I think I was like 9 or 10. Curtains pulled. I mean, I was absolutely shitting it.
Yeah.
And it does mean that I don't like horror films now. Like,
and you haven't had a shower since?
I can't. No.
No. Honestly, so, I mean, Mr. and Mrs. Edwards, what are you thinking?
Well, I think they proved their point. It's a good film.
I'm not sure it's the best way.
No, maybe, to prove maybe that not. Point. I mean, they haven't released a parenting handbook as yet. I respect them for it. But that was deeply terrifying. And actually, I also thought I was going to drown once. I got stuck under a. In fact, I just got stuck underwater, like caught.
Oh, I remember
in,
you telling
in, like,
me, yeah.
Yeah, like reeds and ropes. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to be able to get out of this.
Yeah, that's a weird thought, isn't it?
This is how you
drown.
Yeah, and then thinking, someone saying that drowning's sort of euphoric. It doesn't feel particularly euphoric at the moment.
Not yet.
Just you wait. Picture this. You're home alone, tucked up in bed, and you hear a loud noise in the kitchen. Your muscles tense, palms sweat, heartbeat quickens, skin prickles, and stomach churns. You muster the courage to get up and investigate the noise. Tiptoeing quietly down the hall, you edge closer and closer to where the noise came from. Slowly, you twist the doorknob, open the door, and peer into the room. There, in the corner, surrounded by pots and pans on the ground, is your cat. The fear washes away immediately. You're left with relief. But why does that feeling feel so good? Is it just the feeling of relief, or is it something more? That's why this week we're asking, why do we like to be scared? Because another version of that where you come down and surrounded by the pots and pans is Aphrodite. She's like, come to me, Brooks.
Brooks.
How old do you reckon she was?
She was like late 50s.
So how
black long, hair, dyed black hair. Like beautiful. Really fucking
like,
horrible.
Like straight out of the ring.
Yeah.
How long ago was this?
Oh, this must have been like 20 years ago.
So maybe. She's probably still around, dyeing that hair black.
I'm going to have to look up B&Bs and Hastings and see if she's still on the game.
Is that what? On the game? Well, that's a detail we didn't have.
Oh, did I mention that was free?
Yeah, I mean, I say B&B. I guess if you really scrutinise it...
One of the B's was for brothel.
Yeah. And so was the other one. It's brothel and brothel.
No wonder the breakfast was so bad.
Well, we don't really normally do this, but I'll say we've got some cornflakes. Today we're joined by Stephen Schlossman, which is a good name. He's an associate professor of psychiatry, pediatrics and medical education at Dartmouth Medical School, which is impressive. But, and I really like this about him, he insisted on just being called Stephen.
He's the
only person who calls him doctor or professor is his mum. You could learn a thing or two from this guy.
You're right.
I should
make my mum call me Dr. Brooks as well.
He's also a writer. Most recently wrote a non-fiction book on film and health called Film Arts for Health. But he's also written a number of horror novels and short stories such as The Zombie Autopsies.
Wow.
This guy knows his stuff when it comes to fear.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. I guess reading the zombies' autopsies, and I mean that's sort of going to be scary in a way. I remember reading Dracula and actually finding it quite scary at the start. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's ridiculous the second half, but the first half is quite scary. But that's a different fear from like danger fear, like we're talking about, like planes falling out of the sky or whatever, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, we'll go into this in more detail, but sort of it seems fairly obvious that there's not any enjoyment in immediate, genuine danger.
Right.
And if you do find enjoyment in that, it might be worth checking out our psychopath episode. So I want to tell you about a person I came across in researching this episode who I read about her and was like, this person is fantastic. So she's called Dr. Margie Kerr, and she's a sociologist. And so she's associated with a university, I think. But she also works at somewhere called Scare House in Pittsburgh. And this is a haunted house where they literally spend a year getting ready for that year's haunted house around the Halloween period.
Oh, love
And she
it.
Describes herself as a scare specialist. That's like, what?
I mean, it's niche, but I like it.
It's so good. Like, what? That's a really good thing at a dinner party where you're doing a boring thing, going around, what do you do? Radio, what do you do? Write a book. Yeah, good one. What do you do? I'm a scare specialist. Right. That's who I'm speaking to. That is excellent. And so she spent a lot of time thinking about how to scare people, what the best way of doing it is, and then also why people enjoy it. And it sort of all comes down to, there's two things really. Your first response to being scared is that classic sort of fight or flight.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
your body is like, fucking hell.
This is why you shit yourself.
We need to get ready to defend ourselves or flee or something because we're in danger. And people differ in their chemical response, because that is all chemicals and hormones.
Yeah.
And people do differ. So it's not like, you know, some people you might say, oh, they're a bit of a scaredy cat, and this person doesn't scare easily. That's not a sort of choice necessarily. It might just be that they have slightly different brain chemistry.
Yeah. Okay.
So from the get-go, some people are going to feel these same events differently.
Yeah.
Which kind of, I think, makes a bit of sense, doesn't it? But ultimately, you know, fight or flight, you've got a load of adrenaline, you've got endorphins, you've got dopamine, all this kind of stuff flooding around. And they're all very similar, actually, to the chemicals that you'd have flooding around if you're happy or excited. So you can kind of see where enjoyment might come into it already. But the key thing that we've already sort of alluded to is to enjoy it, you have to know that you are in a safe setting. Like, no one is sort of thinking, yes, I seek out genuine terror where I honestly fear for my life.
Yeah.
That is not fun.
That's sort of an indication that there's something wrong with you.
I would say so, yeah. That doesn't really fly for the vast majority of people.
Yeah.
And what happens in the brain is really interesting. So fear is obviously a very useful sort of evolved bit of biology.
Yeah.
And it's a real continuum as well. So you can see it in, and it's like, again, and we have this discussion quite a lot, don't we, about what sort of what emotional states would mean in animals. But you can see something, you might not call it fear, but a sort of reaction to a threat stimulus.
Yeah.
And that can be as simple as, you know, you touching a snail's antenna and it kind of cringing away.
Yeah.
Or right through to sort of existential angst in humans.
Yeah.
And you can kind of put them on the fear continuum. So it's a whole range of emotions.
Yeah, yeah.
But at its very heart, it's kind of deep wired into arguably all living things,
yeah,
that you need to have something, and it would have evolved over millennia, something that protects you from perceived threats.
Yeah, absolutely essential survival mechanism.
Totally. Yeah. If something's threatening your integrity or your existence, you need to A, be aware of it, and B, probably get the fuck out of
it. Yeah, have an appropriate reaction. Yeah, yeah.
And so that's really clear. But there's two levels to it in humans. So you sort of have your kind of primal animal brain instinct, which is that fight or flight, so that's triggered.
Yeah.
And then you have what you could call your sort of thinking brain, which assesses context. And once it's assessed context and sort of said, oh, actually, you're not really in danger, that is when you enjoy it. So Margie Kerr talks about this a lot. How often you see people in the haunted house jump and scream and then very quickly sort of start smiling and laughing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's literally what's happening. So you're having your sort of your animal brain going, "Frah!" and then your sort of your conscious thinking brain going, "It's all fine. We're just in a haunted house." Yeah, hey! Yeah. And there's a kind of you enjoy that feeling, and there's sort of there's a relief as well, as you realise actually in a kind of almost like a sense of confidence. You've like, oh, we've got through that. That's great. And sort of feeling in control. But it's those two things kind of working, not in opposition, but just working together. And the animal brain always just is quicker because it's almost like a reflex, stuff.
Yeah. So you get past the reflex and then
your brain's
of,
like,
oh,
yeah. Okay.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So presumably, like, I mean, it's hard to imagine, but presumably when humans were living on the savannah and they, you know, relied on their instinct and that kind of, you know, survival instinct, they must still have had some kind of sense of pleasure when it was wrong. Or maybe they scared each other around campfires or something. But, you know, I imagine humans have, like, always had that kind of double reaction.
Yeah, so it's quite messed up in a way, isn't it? You're like, why have we...
It's like a really twisted enjoyment, isn't it? Twisted pleasure.
Yeah, and how long have we been this twisted for, essentially? And so I asked Stephen that.
As long as we've been telling stories, well, when we've been talking, we've been telling stories. And as long as we've been telling stories, we often have scary parts in them. People enjoy suspense. They like feeling their heart rate go up. They like the idea of projecting yourself into the character that you're being told about around whatever primeval campfire you happen to be at. That's why Homer worked. You know, this blind poet wandering around a pretty barbaric time, and he wasn't going to tell poems just about people going for a walk. He was going to tell poems about some pretty scary, awful things, and that makes people lean in. They want to listen to it. And from it, I think we're able to put ourselves in circumstances that are more real, but we can tolerate putting ourselves there more because it's in this, you know, outlandish fictional world.
So it's basically escapism, isn't it? You get caught up in a fictional world, yeah, but you still get to experience real emotions.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, and that, you know, you kind of go, yeah, I get that, I think. And you're getting to experience really sort of high level arousal states, but in that safe environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we've been doing it for, as Stephen was saying, for years and years. And roller coasters is a really interesting one.
Oh, so yeah.
Did a bit of research into this. And they first started sort of proto roller coasters in Russia. And they were called Russian ice slides. It's called mid 17th century. And they're effectively just like extended sleigh rides. So you just go up to the top of a icy mountain, and they would have put in some man-made bumps to make it a bit more, and then you just absolutely bolt down it.
That's sounds fantastic. Quite fun. Yeah.
And then they gradually just sort of elaborated. So, and then by the 18th century, they'd kind of put some wooden beams on to kind of like not quite tracks, but something approaching tracks to kind of keep you roughly along yeah, the path. And then they'd start actually building like artificial ice mountains. And then they bought in tracks and they bought in carriages. And then by the, I think, 19th century, they're starting to do the classic sort of haunted house thing where painting scary images on walls
that you
go past.
Okay.
Really cool, actually. And then in I think it's in Pennsylvania in the 19th century, you had these kind of gravity-powered little railways for coal. And
yeah,
at the weekends, people would rent those out. For
no,
fun. Yeah, just be like, can we have a go
brilliant
on those?
Yeah, yeah,
just be
yeah,
like, yeah, just like razzing down on those. So
the kids were definitely doing that in the evenings, weren't they?
Totally, like really, it makes you excited just thinking.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah,
that's
yeah,
ideal.
Yeah.
So we've been trying that for ages.
I remember back when I was a kid, I was like probably about 11 or 12, playing on a building site with a mate of mine, Jeremy Siddifin, if you're listening. Mm-hmm. And we found this massive drainage pipe, which we realized was at the top of a slope. And so I just got in it and he pushed it. And I just bundled down this slope in this huge drainage. I mean, I must have come out pretty battered and bruised, but
yeah,
I remember the feeling of like, that was brilliant.
Yeah.
Obviously he couldn't do it because we couldn't push it back up the slope. So it was just me.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but euphoria.
And really guess, bloody dangerous when I think about it now.
Well, yeah, but I think that at the time you wouldn't have thought that it was.
No, it didn't even occur to me it was dangerous.
If you had, I think you wouldn't have enjoyed it.
Yeah, probably true.
But you felt like, oh, this would be fine and fun.
Yeah.
I think it's quite useful to think about where fears would come from as well, whether it's sort of innate or learnt, and I think it's a bit of both, really. But you can definitely learn to fear things, and so your socialisation and the place that you grow up in will have a big influence over what you find scary. But you do see themes emerge. So if you think about the kind of like mythical creatures,
yeah.
So whether it's, you know, an abominable snowman or the Loch Ness Monster or whatever, really. One of the things that they tend to all do is sort of in weird ways, like violate the laws of nature. And that always unsettled us.
Yeah.
Always. Like we just kind of, if it doesn't quite make sense, which is why Victorian freak shows like P.T. Barnum stuff, where he'd sort of like sew a monkey's head onto a fish's body,
yeah,
and that
right,
kind of,
right.
And people were like, ah!
And why you had just, the Minotaur in the
yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that yeah, that kind of thing where it's just like, it's just not quite right, it's
yeah,
off.
Yeah.
And that sort of freaks us out, but can be, in, again, quite a sort of pleasurable way. But people can become afraid of anything, and you will love this. So in the 1920s, back when science was science, and you could just
do what you like.
You want to be a bit naughty? Be a bit naughty.
It's science.
Yeah, they did an experiment with little Albert, and little Albert is a baby, and they just sort of, in a classic sort of Pavlovian way,
right,
made Albert terrified of anything white and fluffy.
Oh, amazing.
so they did it with a white rat, actually.
Oh, nice.
And so he's, okay, and a white rat, actually quite cute.
Yeah.
They come in, but as soon as he touched the white rat, you go to sort of pet it.
Not electric,
they just absolutely clatter a metal bar. It's a horrible sound. And they're both like, ah! But the interesting thing about it was, it then wasn't just the rat, so you could bring in like a cute white fluffy bunny,
yeah,
and Albert would be like,
shit himself.
even I think they did it with like a sort of Santa Claus, like someone coming in with a big white fluffy face, terrified. so
amazing,
we know
science.
Yeah. but it's not. I mean, it kind of, you know, proved a sort of point that you can. Yeah. Yes, you can create a fear around sort of, it can be arbitrary.
Right. So we know what happened to Albert in later life.
Well, this bit, because the first bit I was like, yeah, that's terrible. But I suppose that they sorted him out afterwards.
Of course they didn't.
No. But I think they talked about it. And they were, and the lead scientist was like, no, I think that might be more damaging. so they thought, well, we can probably
undo this.
Yeah, but they just left him.
Yeah,
and there's no record, obviously, of sort of how that affected him. It's just, I mean, it's classic. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, well, I know he's going to enjoy that. My man.
Just left him in a field of sheep under some nice white fluffy clouds eating marshmallows.
Yeah, I mean, poor old kid. But whilst we're on experiments that you will love, I found another one that I really enjoyed. And this kind of is looking into whether there's a genetic component. And as I said, like some people, and there will be. It looks like it's a heritable trait, so a tendency towards anxiety or fear in humans looks heritable. And that doesn't mean that you're going to be, like if your mum is scared of this thing, you're going to be scared of this thing. Although nurture may produce
that.
But the tendency to be more scared,
yeah,
yes, and then, you know, your environment will dictate what form that fear eventually sort of manifests itself in. And there's some people obviously have thought, well, I wonder if we can do this with mice. Bring in the mice. And they do what's called an open field test. And the open field test is just a brightly lit box with no hiding places. And you find that you have a real range of reactions to this from mice. So you have mice who will just sniff around and explore and roam and pretty chilled.
Yeah.
And then you have pussy mice. And pussy mice just like sit perfectly still and they cower and they constantly piss and shit themselves. And so... And most mice are somewhere in between. Like,
yeah.
But there's definitely... There's basically brave mice and then the pussy mice. They don't call them pussy mice in the experiment, but that's
what they should.
Yeah, they should do. And so,
spade to spade
and then
that.
You breed the pussy mice together and you have a line of pussy mice.
Brilliant.
So then you just, and they're really highly anxious, fearful mice, and it's not learnt from the family. So what you can do is you can take a pussy mouse and put it in a family full of the nails mice.
Yeah.
So you've got these fearless siblings and fearless mother, and it will still be an absolute pussy because it's hardwired to be a pussy.
Science.
Oh, it's
imagine
so good.
Being that mouse, just shitting yourself the whole time.
But at least,
literally.
At least you don't know any different.
I don't think that's...
No, I know.
That's no comfort, is it?
I know. I know. I mean, you're having a miserable
you
time.
You are having a miserable
really,
life.
Really, really miserable life. But it sort of makes sense then that you couldn't do the same thing with people. You could, anyway, maybe you could actually.
Well, but I think you'll find it in my school playground. Yeah. It sort of happened.
Well, you weren't breeding kids. as I was saying, the sort of specific associations or phobias that someone's going to have are almost exclusively going to come from association with individual, you know, environmental experiences. And which is nurture, and also just because I think it's always worth pointing these things out, it's not that there is a fear gene. Obviously,
yeah,
there's fear and anxiety will be influenced by a whole load of genes, and effectively, coming back to the brain chemistry, what we think is happening is that you've got these genes that control various neurotransmitters and their receptors that are going to be present in various forms across the general population, and then you'll get a particular combination of those from your parents, and they will predispose you to respond to a greater or lesser degree to events in your environment in terms of anxiety.
So they didn't take the pussy mouse and just like do a genetic analysis and find, oh yeah, this is the thing. They're just literally like, oh, we haven't really learnt much from that apart from
it's heritable.
Yeah.
And difficult to overcome.
Yeah. Is there any comfort to the mouse involved?
No, I don't think so.
No. The mouse is like, I could have told you that.
Yeah. Yeah. You just had to ask. Honestly. but then not true for the mice, but for us, it then becomes all about your individual histories. You know, the type and the strength and the number and duration of events in your life that sort of fit that kind of fear profile will then influence how much your lives are affected by it.
And this is why you don't watch black and white films anymore, presumably.
Well, no, horror films. Black and white I'm fine with. Horror films. No, thank you.
Well done, Mr. and Mrs. Edwards.
Yeah. But you can also, have sort of, again, this is something that old Margie from Scarehouse or whatever it's called talked about. It's the fact you can have good scares and bad scares, and it's effectively about getting the balance right.
Yeah.
So you want enough excitement caused in the sort of, but as in fear caused in like your animal brain, and then enough sort of sense of control in your sort of contextual thinking brain. And if the emotional brain is too terrified, then and the cognitive brain is sort of can't override it, that is not going to be great.
Yeah.
And equally, if the emotional brain is a bit bored, and the cognitive brain is sort of too suppressed, and it's not so fun.
All right.
So there's sort of a sweet spot in terms of
I would say
scare people.
Like, I remember going to Alton Towers, and the sweet spot for me is the roller coasters are scary but enjoyable.
Yeah.
Whereas I went on the Saw ride, I think that was Alton Towers.
Yeah.
It was just unpleasant. I mean, the whole thing is unpleasant start to finish.
Yeah. I mean, that's my experience of roller coasters. I like it when there's sort of a bit of light and shade, so there's bits where you're like, ah, this is nice, and we're going quite fast, but we all feel like a clock. And then a horrifying bit, and then back to whereas some of them are just like relentless. Let me off, let me off, you pricks. Yeah, I don't like that.
Yeah,
and then the reason that for me anyway, that seemingly, and this very much fits in with the model we're talking about, that seemingly quite sort of straightforward fairground rides are terrifying is because you don't trust that the people who've put the thing together have done it correctly.
Yes. Yeah.
So there's the fear that this is actually
dangerous. And sometimes that fear is justified.
Well, I remember being on a fairground sort of galleon, you know, the one that just sort of, and every time I went past the ground, I'd just see these bolts lying on the floor. I was just like, what the f-? Like, where's that supposed to be? Like, it was horrible.
I wonder if they put those bolts there.
I think they might.
As a way of getting into your head.
Well, it worked with me. It shit me right up. I couldn't wait for it to end.
Is there like a public mood that sort of changes how much we enjoy horrors as well? I mean, like, if you're in the middle of a war, like something like that, you know, you're not going to be looking for horror films because, you know, stuff is happening around you.
You've got enough horror.
Yeah. So, but I imagine there's a kind of sense of, like, you know, we're in austerity at the moment. Maybe people aren't looking for sort of those kind of scares. Is that true?
Well, I kind of put this to Stephen, actually, because I've read stuff about this before, and I'm slightly unconvinced.
Horror films increase in popularity during times of global distress, or during times of, say, national distress if they're within a specific nation. I know that literature more about zombies because that was what I wrote about for a while, and there was a whole literature about zombie stories becoming more popular during times of economic distress. That has held up more or less, and it's a little, you know, it's a correlation, it's not a causation, so we get to then think out loud about the causes. And I think the causes are, again, that we're feeling this general sense of uneasiness and uncertainty, and we don't like that feeling. So we go to a place where we can have that same feeling, but in a way that's contained and fictional, that allows us then to practice it, to get better at it, and also to think about how we ourselves respond to this sense of unease.
I mean, with zombies, it's obviously like, you know, I bet during the pandemic, because that whole thing about, you know, there's movies and stuff that we associate with things like viral outbreaks and everything. So I imagine that people wanted to explore that kind of stuff during the pandemic.
Well, there was a massive, I think, Contagion, the Jude Law film about a viral pandemic, which is a pretty good depiction of what it could be like and turned out to be like.
Netflix put that back on Netflix,
it was hugely popular. Yeah. So it went from being, I think it's a Warner Brothers film, it went from being like, and they have a sort of record of who's watching their back catalogue. It was sort of like 240th, and then it was second most watched. Like people were really like, yeah, I'll have a go on this. But that's a sort of, there's nothing very complicated about that, I don't think. It's just like, well, people literally at the very start were like, Jesus Christ, what's going to happen here?
Yeah, it's all curiosity driven.
It's not, I want to be scared by it. I just want to know what might be about to happen in our lives. But there is some interesting stuff about horror and why at certain times in a sort of country, sort of cultural, economic climate, certain things become more popular, which I think I'm a bit skeptical about, but we'll talk about it. And also why horror movies are the perfect date movie. And we'll try and answer today's question, why do we like to be scared, after this quick break.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
And we're back. So, there's this idea that during sort of periods of suffering in various forms, horror movies get more popular. And I sort of wonder, like, the reason that studios like making horror films is that they can be really cheap and make a lot of money. So I just wonder if there's something going on with that more than... Like, it's slight. I can't quite work out what's coming first.
Well, also, people aren't choosing when a horror movie... I guess, in some ways, you know, things that are already made, you can choose to watch. But, like, stuff that's coming out on release, that's planned, like, years and years in advance.
Yeah.
So that's not a response.
Although horror films can also be made quite quickly. Like, there is a chance that it could respond. But I just don't really know what the mechanism would be for that.
Yeah.
But there are some correlations, like you can see them. So that during the Great Depression, you had Dracula, Frankenstein, King Kong, all sort of came out. You kind of go, okay, yeah, fine,
yeah.
And then in the next sort of big horror generation, you could argue was in the mid 70s. So you've got like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre come out in 1974, and that's right slap bang in the middle of the recession
big
in America
recession,
around
73
at 75. I just don't know if you can. I'm wary of saying much about. A lot of people have written about it.
Because you can imagine just having, you know, studio execs having a conversation saying, right, well, you know, things are a bit shit at the moment, so we're only going to make cheap movies for the next couple of years.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that
and then you get your horror movies.
Yeah. And then people love to try and sort of figure out what the symbolism of, so zombie movies.
Yeah.
So zombie movies really went up in popularity sort of post 9/11. And then immediately... Well, it sort of carried on, but then immediately after the crash, and you know, I think you can sort of quite chin strokey people will say, "Well, the zombies represent blah 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 blah."
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know. I feel like,
well, it's post hoc, isn't it? You could almost get any kind of justification for it if you choose that narrative.
Yeah. I mean, I just wonder if I could find enough films in any given year to support any argument.
Basically, we call bullshit.
I think so.
Which is not like us at all.
On this. Not in the slightest. But just, I know that people listening will have come across that as a thing that people talk about. And I think it's less convincing than people make out.
What about watching things alone versus watching things with other people? So that I don't really like watching a horror film on my own. I get almost no pleasure from that, I would say. There's something about the sharing of it, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But if you think back to our festival episode, that really makes sense. Like, we are very social animals. We get a lot from sharing experiences with people, you know, that collective effervescence idea. We see that, you know, audiences' heartbeats will kind of sync up when they're in high states of arousal and stuff like that. So it does make sense that you would want to watch sort of
they're better at a cinema, aren't they?
Things together. Yeah, absolutely. That collective experience is great. And so I asked Stephen about this.
I think the camaraderie that gets created, both with people you already know, and also it's a great way. I mean, unless it's a really, really dark horror film, it's a great date movie when you think about it, because you can get close in a way that's not uncomfortable. I don't mean to sound creepy, but this is why people go to horror films, for that reason. Now, there are some horror films, just out of curiosity, that actually kind of did incredibly well despite that. Like Night of the Living Dead's a perfect example, 1968. That, you know, it came out at the same time people were seeing movies like I Dated a Teenage Werewolf. Those were like cautionary tales that don't date somebody older than you, and we'll use the metaphor the werewolf. Night of the Living Dead's absolutely devastating. And people went there as date movies thinking that this would give them an excuse to sort of, you know, hug each other and walk out laughing. And instead they went out and had really deep existential discussions. So the other thing that a horror film can do is you can laugh at it, but there's no way to watch Midsommar, for example, and not at the end of it come out and ask yourself all sorts of questions like, was it okay that those old folks jumped off the cliff? Or what do you think about a graduate student pursuing his thesis at the expense of everything else? Like, we've all met those graduate students. What does that mean? Like you get to have conversations even about yourself that would not be possible in outside of that displacement, that horror.
Have you seen either of those films?
No, because I can't watch scary films.
No, I've not seen either of them either.
I keep thinking I should watch Midsommar because everyone says it's excellent. But
I don't know. I mean, old people jumping off a cliff, I'm already put off.
Well, that when I heard that, I was like, oh, that actually sounds all right.
Oh, really? Oh,
okay. Yeah, but if they're old already, then, you know.
Oh. Oh, okay.
You know what I mean?
That's where you are, is it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Well, you know what? I'm firmly.
You wait. You wait till your turn comes around.
When I'm 80, I'm out. I've always said it. I'm not going to do it by jumping off a cliff, probably. But no, I haven't seen Midsommar. I haven't seen Night of the Living Dead. But Night of the Living Dead, by all accounts, is absolutely
terrifying.
Like, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be able to handle that at all.
You should actually make your parents watch it.
Yeah. 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 Fuck you. But I think that you just sort of mentioned it, like we do the sort of the sharing of the fear is a big part.
Yeah,
of
definitely.
Why we like it. So if you think it's obvious, isn't it? If you go around a haunted house on your own,
yeah, I mean, it's just sort of, weird.
You're the creepiest guy in there. Is that guy on his own? Is he part of the thing? I don't know, but I don't like it.
No, you wouldn't want him to come up to you, would you?
No. God. Room for Brooks. but the other sort of interesting thing about your brain is it really remembers how it felt when you watched or experienced something like that with friends,
and it
likes it and it just wants to repeat it. So that's why.
Is it like a bonding experience?
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it would be, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And hence Stephen's, I think Stephen just about managed to avoid being creepy.
It was a close run thing.
It was, but he knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
But he went on to talk about how that kind of applies in other contexts as well, not just sort of obviously sort of scary, sort of like fear jump scares, but sort of sporting exhilaration and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of folks who've written about this. So there's some data that when those increased stressful moments happen, there's an endorphin release, which is a little bit of hand-wavy science where they say something good happens in your brain that feels good, and so we go back and seek it again and again. There's certainly a literature out there about people who are more thrill-seeking or stimulus-seeking, who actually need a little bit more in order to get themselves excited. Some people are perfectly excited by a rainy day and its beauty. Other people need there to be a rainy day and to see a tree limb come down or something. Like you can, we're all very, very different. But generally speaking, the opportunity to experience a stressful circumstance in a safe setting is pretty good for us, because then we learn we can tolerate that feeling. We do the same thing at sporting events too, when you think about it. The penalty kick makes everybody stressed.
So there's a theory that some people have brains that lack the sort of brakes, for want of a better word, on both dopamine release and reuptake.
Yeah.
And those people will tend to be, I think it's called like T-type or something, so like thrill seekers. And they just like those kind of thrilling activities.
Yeah, okay.
And again, it just comes back to this thing. It's just the brain chemistry is a little bit different for some reason. But I like the idea that stress can be good for you, because you immediately, you hear things like cortisol getting released. You're like, well, that's not good.
Yeah.
Because that's stress, and stress is bad, because we're told the whole time that stress is bad. But it turns out that not all stress is bad. And you can have this thing called eustress, which literally means good stress. So you in Greek means good, hence like euphoria.
Okay.
And some Dutch guys did a really nice, simple experiment with asthmatics, where if you put asthmatics in a stressful situation, generally, they will perceive their symptoms as being more severe, their asthma symptoms as being more severe. And you go, yeah, that figures. And they whack them on a roller coaster. And being on a roller coaster, your lung function does physiologically decreases because of all the sort of the agitation forces, and screaming and blah, blah, blah. But their experience is that they of shortness of breath is reduced, so they don't feel that their asthma symptoms are as bad.
Okay,
because they've had a sort of effectively a positive experience of stress. They've experienced eustress, what they would say.
Yeah.
So the idea that stress is always bad is not quite right.
Hold on. So you put them on a roller coaster and they've still got asthma.
They've still got asthma.
But their experience of asthma is just
isn't
it just displaced by the stress of dealing with the circumstances of the roller coaster? So they stop thinking about their asthma? Or is there some way to control for that?
Because
if you just stick them in there a stressful situation.
But you're asking them afterwards. So I don't know. I know what you mean. That is it just a distraction?
Yeah, yeah.
But I suppose that the thing that is clear is that you've put them into normally a normal stressful situation.
Yeah,
so
where I
guess
cortisol
level
you could
goes up.
Say that they're distracted
and
that.
Their symptoms, their self perceived symptoms worsen.
Yeah.
But then you put them in another sort of positive stressful situation, the roller coaster, and their asthma symptoms are reduced.
Yeah.
So the difference is clear, I think.
Because basically they enjoyed themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. They enjoyed themselves even though they got loads of stress.
It was stress.
Yeah, it was stress.
But it's almost like a good stress.
Good stress. Good stress. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll buy that.
Something else that I just wanted to add in is that there's a, I don't know if anyone thinks this anymore, but it's definitely a very old school vibe that women find stuff scarier than men. And when you do self-reported studies into this, you do find that women say they are more scared of stuff.
Yeah.
However,
cultural baggage on that.
Yeah. There? However, when you hook people up and measure all of the sort of physical symptoms of fear, it turns out basically men are just lying, just being the big man.
Of course they are.
Yeah. And so there's no, of course. But there's no physiological difference between men and women in terms of their reaction to fear.
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
I'm almost surprised you didn't say the men are more scared than the women.
No, I don't think there's any evidence of that. It's right. just it's just when
everyone's appropriately scared, some yeah. people aren't admitting it.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly that. And also, here's a good thing. I'm just adding in stuff that I forgot to mention before, but I think you'll like.
Go on.
Is that of all of those kind of classic physical responses, so those fight or flight responses that immediately happen to get you ready, triggered by, and it can be triggered literally by anything from like seeing a predator to like we're really good, we react very quickly to the emotion that we see on other people's faces. So if you see someone terrified, you're pretty quick to be like, I'm ready. Yeah. I'm ready to be terrified. Yeah. But you activate, you know, the various sort of hormone releases, and suddenly, you know, your brain is sort of hyper alert, and your pupils dilate, and your bronchi dilate, and your breathing rate increases, your heart rate increases, and your blood pressure goes up, and blood flow goes away from the skin, and any of those functions that probably aren't going to be useful in fight or flight. And so you're just trying to supply all the organs that are vital, so muscles really, or skeletal muscles at least.
Yeah, is that why hair stand up?
Yeah, exactly.
Because
that
you get colder.
Yeah, Well, yes, because blood flow has gone, and also that all of those muscles, those little erector muscles in the skin.
It's to get big at those moments.
Yeah, and it doesn't really work for us. But if you're a hirsute animal.
Yeah.
Then you look bigger.
Yeah.
But the thing that I really liked and I'd never really thought about is that your tummy and your intestinal system is not vital at that point. And so blood flow is reduced to that. And that's why you get the sensation of butterflies. It's just like a strain. Okay. It's like your sort of gastrointestinal function kind of being put on pause.
Yeah.
And it just feels weird.
And that's what butterflies
Yeah, and that's what butterflies is. Yeah.
Nerves.
Yeah.
Because
you're ready. You're ready.
Yeah. You're ready to shit yourself.
Yeah. Not ready to shit yourself, weirdly.
Surely it should be working at that point.
Yeah, I don't quite know how that works.
The colon's flooded with blood.
Yeah, the colon's like, I'm good to go. Let's get this out of it. Let's get this out. Certainly if you're one of the pussy mice. So... The question is, why do we like being scared? I think the answer is just...
Because it's good for us.
It's good for us. It's a distraction. It's genuinely pleasurable to feel fear in a safe environment. So your animal brain experiencing that, and then your thinking brain saying... And the great news is you don't really need to be scared.
Yeah. So it's a weird side effect of evolution, effectively.
Yeah, yeah. And of course you evolve to be... It's good to be cautious. Like, we're very cautious.
Yeah.
But you'd rather shit yourself seeing a shadow and be like, I better run, than not. And then be like, oh, no, that was a bear.
I should have run.
That was a bear. So yeah, I think it's just that, and it's nice to sort of experience a bit of uncertainty and danger.
Yeah,
and certain people like it more than others, and that's just partially genetic, and it will be partially environmental as well. And I think all your brain is really doing is scanning for sort of unusual things and novelty.
Yeah,
it's constantly predicting everything, and sort of. Shaking things up a bit is quite good for it.
Yeah.
Anyway, we asked Stephen, why do we like being scared?
We like being scared because it gives us the opportunity to experience uncertainty, a fight or flight response, to play with our brain's capacity for pattern recognition and to tweak it just a little bit, and to know without question, given that it's fictional horror that we're seeing, that we will survive. That's a great experience for us. That allows us to look at our world in ways that we're really frightened to look at otherwise, and to answer some pretty tough questions that we otherwise were afraid to ask.
So that thing about ultimately you know you will survive is the key, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, this is just a pretend. It's just play.
Mm.
Yeah, you're not a pussy mouse. you just put yourself. You've chosen to be here.
The pussy mouse is not enjoying any of this. Though,
no, there's no pleasure.
Unfortunately,
there.
Yeah. No, yeah, and some of us are pussy mice.
Yeah,
in a way.
Yeah,
get in touch if you are.
But you don't. I mean, you don't put yourself in that position.
No,
do you?
No, no.
Which is
no.
interesting in the sense because it can be pleasurable, and yet you still don't do it.
But probably not pleasurable for you though, if you're a pussy mouse.
No. And let's face it, we're talking about you here.
This is a serious science show, right? Which is ended in us trying to work out basically whether I'm a pussy mouse.
Yeah, yeah, and you are.
Yeah, I think I am, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Eureka is a Stack production presented by Dr. Michael Brooks and Rick Edwards. The production team is Temi Adebayo, Katie Baxter, Luke Moore and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to today's expert, Professor Stephen, don't call me Professor, Schlossman. Please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a massive difference. We also really love hearing from you guys, so if you have any burning questions you want us to answer, drop us an email at eureka@stack.london, or you can find us, as always, on Twitter at EurekaPod.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.